with us, and we are so glad you are free. We will continue to follow the story of what is taking place in Egypt. Tarek Bulubani is a doctor and professor at Western University in London, Ontario, where he's speaking to us from, and John Grayson, filmmaker, member of Queers Against Israeli Apartheid. They were imprisoned by the Egyptian regime for 50 days and ultimately released. If you'd like a copy of today's show, you can go to our website at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Renee Feltz, Sarah Mate, Nermin Sheikh, Steve Martinez, Sam Alkoff, Hani Masood, Rabbi Karen Dean, guys, during the little field, I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, where the time is 8 a.m. Stay tuned next for Positively Revolting Talk Radio. Paul Rowland will guest host this morning and will speak with Larry Bensky, longtime Pacifica and KPFA program host. Coming up next, right after this announcement.
Did you know that KBOO's daily evening newscast is produced by a team of volunteers right here in our Portland studios? If you've got some extra time and would like to get free training in radio news production, come on down to the studio and get involved. You can learn interviewing, writing, editing, and production skills, all for free, in a fun and supportive environment. Call KBOO's volunteer coordinator, Ani Haynes, at 503-231-8032 to get involved. That number again is 503-231-8032 to volunteer with the KBOO Evening News.
Truth is, I thought it mattered. I thought that music mattered. But does it bollocks? Not compared to how people matter.
Good morning. You're listening to Positively Revolting. You'd usually hear Ani and Lynn. That's time slot. My name's Paul Rowland. I'm sitting in. They're on vacation for a while. And I just couldn't resist playing that song. I know they usually play another Chumbawamba song as they start out their show. So I thought I'd play their big hit that raised a lot of controversy with their fans at the time. Actually, I saw Chumbawamba in D.C. They were on a tour to support that album, and I looked around and they're all like 20-somethings, and I think that was the only song they ever heard of them. Anyway, my little Chumbawamba story. I do have on the phone Larry Bensky from, where are you at, Larry?
Berkeley, California.
Good morning. How are you doing this morning?
Oh, I'm in post-Halloween spin.
Yeah.
I had to get a couple of teenagers out of the house to high school, but now we're good.
All right. Well, you were at Pacifica for a long time. We've been talking a lot about Pacifica the last few weeks. We were playing this film, KPFA, on the air 13 years after it was produced. But I don't think a lot of people up here have seen it. They may have seen it down when it was played on PBS back at the time. It was a Point of View sponsored film documentary about the history of KPFA and Pacifica. And you were involved at Pacifica and KPFA for many, many years, 38, if I read correctly.
Yeah, I started in 1969 as a volunteer once a week program co-host, and I finished in 2007 as national affairs correspondent with a weekly talk show.
But I got to say, I've been reading various articles about you and bios, and you had a really interesting history. You were at the Paris Review from 1964 to 66. Who would have thought that? And you were at Ramparts Magazine. You were at some of these amazing places at amazing times. Ramparts Magazine, which was widely influential, a radical investigative magazine, in 1968. You were at the New York Review of Books briefly before that. And you've had also done a lot of activism over the years, anti-nuclear, anti-war activism. I guess what I read in some of these things, you consider yourself, or they considered you, I guess maybe you consider yourself an activist journalist. Is that fair?
No question.
Okay. And that's kind of the tradition I feel like I come out of, and a lot of people at KBOO, and that's kind of what community radio, our brand of community radio anyway, fancies itself as, kind of activist journalist type of media. And that's what I'd like to talk to you about over the next hour, and people will have a chance to call in, give us a chance to sort of get this started, hear Larry talk about his early and his whole career, and then you can call in at 503-231-8187, say around a quarter, 20 after, something like that. Yeah, so talk about, when did you first actually hear of Pacifica?
Well, before that, I just wanted to add one little bio note. I'm also a teacher, a college teacher. I've been a college teacher since 1987, and I'm now in my 21st year teaching at California State University East Bay in Hayward here, one of our state colleges. I teach mass media studies. I taught for years, and in the last 10 years, I've been teaching political science. And I also teach at the OSHA Lifetime Learning Institute at UC Berkeley, which is an adult education program. And just to make the picture complete, for the last 7 years since retiring from the tortured precincts of Pacifica and KBFA, I've been working, designing and maintaining a website about Marcel Proust and late 19th and early 20th century French literature, which is available to anybody who wants to look at it, at Radio Proust. That's one word, radioproust.org. So, it's been a long and varied life, and I hope it continues to be even longer and stays as varied.
Well, in honor of Proust, we're going to talk about some memories here. And,
okay, good. Now, to answer your question, I first became aware of Pacifica after I returned from Paris, where I lived for over 3 years, as you mentioned. In the 60s, I was editor of the Paris Review, but I was also being very politically active over there, as I have been throughout my life, whenever I can, wherever I can.
Well, that's right. Well, I'd like you to talk about that a little bit, because you actually organized some of the early demonstrations against the Vietnam War in France, and, Europe was really active really early against the Vietnam War. So you must have seen kind of some interesting things there.
I did indeed. I was one of the founders, three of us, of a group called PAX, the Paris American Committee in Solidarity with the Vietnamese. And we organized demonstrations in the mid-60s, including a march on the American Embassy on July 4th, 1966. Somewhere there's a picture of me at the head of that march along with Thich Nhat Hanh, the reputed and famous and wonderful Buddhist monk who's still with us today. At that time, as some of your listeners know or remember, the Buddhists in Vietnam were very active in opposing first the French intervention, and after the French lost and left, the United States intervention. And Thich Nhat Hanh happened to be in Paris, and so he and I were the head of that march of several thousand people, including over 1,000 Americans who were students over there or working over there. And that was a great, great experience. I first heard of Pacifica Radio basically after I returned from, I guess I'd heard it in New York where I lived for a couple of years before going to France, but I began to be a regular listener in the late 60s to WBAI in New York. And parenthetically, we should say that so far and so sadly has Pacifica fallen that station in New York, the Pacifica station, is now up for lease or possibly for sale. They've never been able to get themselves together in the last 10 years or so internally to run it properly, always fighting with each other and fighting with the national board and spending a ton of time on the air trying to raise money, which nobody gives because they have very few listeners. And finally, it looks like they're throwing in the towel and either leasing the station to an outside entity or selling it, which is, for me and everybody else who's worked to build up Pacifica over the years, a very, very sad denouement.
Well, I'd like to...
But at that time, when I started listening to it in the late 60s, it was a very live and vibrant and eccentric station, a place which was really free speech radio, where people could come and had access, could play any kinds of music they wanted, could talk about any kind of politics they wanted, were anchored by the great Bob Fast, the legendary host of Radio Unnameable, which was on the air, and I believe is still on the air one night a week, from midnight to 3 or 4 a.m. I'm told, I haven't seen it yet, that there was a documentary made about him, which was also broadcast on PBS, like the wonderful documentary that you're talking about that's about to show up there in Portland, and I hope as many people will go to it as possible and support KABU in that way. So I began to be a listener to WBAI in New York. I didn't get involved in being on the air till I moved out here in 1969, as managing, in 1968 actually, as managing editor of Ramparts magazine that you mentioned.
Well,
I became a listener to KPFA.
Well, let's stay at WBAI for just a second. And
sure.
You know, I'd like to get into the kind of what led up to the current troubles with the ongoing and current troubles with Pacifica and WBAI. But so at the time, Pacifica didn't really have a kind of a national feel to it. It's pretty much just the individual stations at the time.
Correct.
Yeah.
There was no national programming until the early 1970s. There were tapes distributed, but you have to realize, and I'm sure your listeners realize as well as you do, that there were no satellites then, so you couldn't distribute things except over phone lines, and those phone lines weren't very good. So if you wanted to have something on the air for any length of time, it became hard to listen to until the satellite era came in much later. But no, the stations were dedicated to localism and to representation and presence from their local communities. And that had been the founding idea, as people will see when they go see this wonderful documentary, KPFA on the Air. That had been the original impetus for the founding of Pacifica 20 years before I joined it in the 1940s by a group of pacifists during World War II who felt that these were people who, I mean, got to remember, this was the good war. This isn't the Vietnam War. But there were a small number of pacifists during World War II who believed that killing to stop killing doesn't work, and they weren't going to participate in any war, in any armed activity. And they couldn't get the word out to other people because there were very few radio stations then. Television hadn't become invented yet, really, or mass media. And the newspapers were blocked from their point of view, and they decided they needed their own radio station to get out pacifist, anti-war, pro-human solidarity messages. And so they started getting people together to put a radio station on the air in Berkeley, California, and eventually they did.
I did watch the film myself, and I do recommend it. It's and hopefully we're going to have a little short about KABU as well at the event and some discussion afterwards. You were working at Ramparts magazine. Maybe you could just talk a little bit about that too, briefly.
Well, I was working not at the New York Review of Books, as you said, but at the New York Times Book Review.
Oh, I'm sorry.
One of the editors. And I was also writing for the Daily New York Times, and I was at night working in the anti-war movement. I would take off my tie and go down to this shabby walk-up office on Union Square in New York, where there was an organization called the Fifth Avenue Vietnam Peace Parade Committee, which was affiliated with my Paris group. If I ever got my CIA file, it would be really interesting to see what they have about me at the time.
No doubt.
Sure it's expensive. I never bothered to get it. But it was very unglamorous work. I mean, many of your listeners, I'm sure, go back to those days when organizing meant having long, long meetings in smoke-filled rooms where everybody, while we were talking and trying to figure out whatever else we were trying to figure out, was stuffing envelopes full of circulars and letters and putting things in envelopes and addressing the envelopes and sticking on stamps. So they were basically work parties because we had no internet. The telephone answering machine didn't even exist. If you called somebody and they weren't home, you couldn't leave a message. And the people are always asking me, especially my college students when we get to talking about this, well, how did you ever organize anybody? How did you ever get anything done? Well, we did. We couldn't send them emails. We couldn't send text messages. We couldn't even leave phone messages.
Well, maybe there are fewer distractions.
It was a different era.
Yeah.
But But I was working at night when I was at the New York Times Book Review. At night, I'd go down every night of the week to have these long meetings in smoke-filled rooms, organizing demonstrations and rallies, and trying to figure out things. I also worked on and was a part of the planning for Martin Luther King's appearance at the United Nations in 1967 in the great speech he gave when he was an anti-war activist by then. And I also, earlier in life, when I was working in publishing, attended the March on Washington in 1963, whose anniversary we just commemorated. So I was around in those years getting my chops any way I could, trying to support and work on the anti-war movement. Now, that's a long story. You ask how the Ramparts magazine was. It was very, very difficult. I was recruited out of the New York Times because I had all these skills in meeting deadlines, editing, writing, things like that. And Ramparts was a disorganized mess and needed somebody who knew professionally how to be a print journalist. And since I was also one of the few people at the Times who had political cred, as you might say, they offered me, at that time they had money, which was the equivalent to what I was making at the Times, to move to San Francisco, where I'd only been briefly once before in my life. And I was frustrated at the Times because I was writing articles and trying to do features and book reviews about the anti-war movement and peace movement, and I was having my pieces spiked, that is to say killed, not run, censored. I was getting into all kinds of issues with the ruling elite in the editorial department of the New York Times, and I realized that that wasn't what I wanted to be doing, was fighting to get my stuff done. I wanted to go somewhere where I had a freer hand and people were more in sync with my political sympathies. So I moved to Ramparts, but Ramparts proved to be incalculably disorganized. Even somebody like me with a lot of experience in meeting deadlines and being creative about it couldn't deal with the eccentricities of the top people there. And I didn't even last a year as managing editor. But while I was there, we managed to increase our appearance from once a month to twice a month, which, of course, made it even more impossible to meet deadlines. And our circulation increased, doubled. We were, I believe, at one point up around 250,000, 300,000 copies, which was huge in those years for a radical anti-war, pro-civil rights publication.
Well, I'm sure you don't want to leave the listeners with the impression that the main thing about Ramparts was its disorganization. I mean, obviously, it was... Tell us about some of the articles. It was a widely influential. I mean, it had some really good investigative reporting as well, right?
Right. It did. And one of the things I'm proudest of is that I was the editor of the Diaries of Che Guevara when they first came out after he was killed by the CIA in Bolivia. There was a manuscript that had a tortured history, and the CIA got their hands on it and wanted to put out their version of it with their editorial changes, and we got the original, and we were able to get it translated and printed. Despite their efforts to try and to thwart us in doing so, I actually flew from San Francisco to a printing plant in Long Island with it secreted on my body.
Wow.
This was pre-security checks at airplane entrances, and in order to, you know, we knew that sending it in the mail was not going to be safe. I had to have a courier, and the courier had to be somebody responsible who could work with a printer. So I flew across the country with it and brought it to the printer who put it in print, and we were able to produce a special edition of that. We had many, many important anti-war articles. The first anti-war GI, Donald Duncan, who turned against the war in Vietnam and described what had gone over there. We were the ones who published Eldridge Cleaver, the author of Soul on Ice, who later had a very different type of denouement to his life, but at that point was a very widely respected African-American militant, and much, much other material. There's a history of Ramparts that came out a few years ago, Paul, about called A Bomb in Every Issue, which was not exactly true. We were not a bomb-throwing magazine, but it's a good, sexy title for a book. So people who are more interested in that era can read A Bomb in Every Issue. But it was a very widely read and respected publication. And at the same time, including there in Portland, there were a number of local, hundreds of local newspapers that grew up, weeklies, which I later took part in right after Ramparts Magazine out here in San Francisco, that were tremendously influential because the establishment media, much as it had been 20, 25 years earlier during the Second World War, was completely blocked to anti-war views, much less to cultural progressivism and the explosion of the counterculture. So it was a super exciting time. And then when I started getting involved in Pacifica Radio in the late 60s, Pacifica had by that time become a very kind of fossilized, antiquated broadcast, not open to the anti-war movement as it had evolved as a dynamic and cultural field. For example, the public affairs director at the time, if you wanted to get a radio show on about current affairs on KPFA at the time in the late 60s, the woman, who's a wonderful woman named Elsa Knight Thompson, and who was the original public affairs director, she had a requirement that the program had to be recorded at least a week beforehand so she could listen to it and reflect on it and determine any changes. So there were no live talk shows, no, you know, street reporting, no anything. The damn thing had to be on a shelf on tape for a week before you could put it on the air. Well, a week is a million years in developing political struggles. And so all of that had to be taken on and transformed, and I was part of the movement that came into KPFA and did that in the early 70s.
That's really interesting, because she comes off as such a, as you say, a wonderful, interesting figure in the film. And obviously in her day, she was kind of the person who was doing what you guys were doing with her. I guess there's that endless generational thing. She had obviously gotten kind of set in her ways by that time.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly.
It happens. And,
but a great historical figure and somebody I was privileged to know. She was also a massive control freak, obviously, and had to have her paw prints on everything, which, you know, I mean, the whole history of Pacifica and KPFA and all of this is a struggle between very eccentric and in many cases very worthy personalities and the idea of trying to and being able to work together in order to get individual messages out, and in trying to work together in order to have some sort of political movement that you were a part of, but also trying to maintain, in some cases, in my case especially, some journalistic distance from it, so that it, although it could be clear, and I hope in my case always was clear, what side you were on and what you believed, you also were open to development of understanding of who didn't believe what you believed and why and what power they had and what they were trying to do. Because unless you understand that, you're not going to get very far. If all you are is an echo chamber for yourself and people who agree with you, that has a function. It's very reassuring, and it can be very ennobling and inspiring, but it doesn't advance things, in my experience, at all. So you have these central contradictions between personality and process, and these central contradictions between content and mission, if you will. And if you see that film, and I hope your listeners will go see KPFA on the air, I think it brilliantly demonstrates how a lot of those played out.
Mm-hmm. So you got in, you started doing your own programming. When did you start doing your own shows there at KPFA?
I started doing my own shows basically as a street reporter in about 1971 or two. For some reason, actually, because when I was young, I used to do amateur sports casting. I had a gift, and still I think have it probably if I ever wanted to use it, in being able to describe what I see on the air in words and bringing it out in word pictures. And not everybody can do that. In fact, very few people do it well. And if you don't believe me, listen to any sports broadcast on the radio or television, and you'll see how incompetent so many of them are. There's some great ones who are very competent, but it's a gift I happen to have. I don't know where it came from, probably from my mother, who never shut up her whole life. But it became technically possible in those years, although you had to do it from phone booths. This is how there were no cell phones, there were no portable phones even. In order to describe what was going on somewhere, you had to get to a phone booth and call up the station and go on the air live, which I did in many instances, not just there, but also at KSAN. I was part of the founding generation of alternative freeform rock radio in the Bay Area. I worked at KMPX and KSAN before I came to KPFA. So I got into radio right after Ramparts Magazine. I still was doing print and alternative newspapers. But I got into radio and brought a generation of people over to KPFA. And our whole claim to fame at that time was doing a lot of live broadcasts from streets. Berkeley, where the station was and is located, was right in the middle of the free fire zone at People's Park and all the anti-war protests. We were able to broadcast those. So that's how I got my start. And then another thing I was always able to do is talk radio, because I have a gift for being able to listen to people and respond to them and mix in voices and stuff like that. So, yeah, we became a very vibrant and lively station in the early 70s here in Berkeley. And at that time, it finally became possible for us to have nationwide broadcasting. It was still by phone lines. There was a genius engineer named Jeremy Landsman, who now runs a station up in Alaska. And he came with us to Miami in 1972 to the Democratic and Republican conventions, which were a total siege, the McGovern and Nixon nomination, Nixon renomination. And there was a huge demonstration by anti-war people there, and counterculture, and huge attacks by the police, and tear gassing. And I was right in the middle of all of that, broadcasting from not phone booths by then. They had portable phones, but they weighed about 50 pounds. You had to have a big device on your back. Now, if people have ever been in Miami in the middle of the summer in August, they know what the weather's like there. And to have to run around the streets with 50 pounds on your back and tear gas coming in your face quite a bit and running away from the cops and their clubs.
Must have really felt like war zone reporting.
It did and it didn't. I mean, you had to realize that we knew what war zones were. We'd seen lots and lots of Vietnam vets come back by then, and lots of people died in Vietnam. And so I never thought of myself as in a war zone, because only two or three times in my life did I actually get shot at domestically. Tear gas is one thing, you know, getting napalm from the air is another, or having 50 caliber weapons trained on you. So I never wanted to conflate what I was doing with the enormous risk and sacrifice that the troops are facing in Vietnam. But, yeah, it was dangerous and difficult. But I was a little younger. I could run faster.
So, Larry, I just got to interrupt, because I just got handed a note from the engineer saying that I got two calls to identify who you are talking to. They're very interested. And I've been remiss in repeating that I am talking with Larry Bensky, longtime KPFA person in various guises, national correspondent. He was station manager for a few years, longtime public affairs producer. He had a talk show called The Sunday Salon for many, many years. And he's been talking about that with me here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland. And KPFA, of course, started out in 1949 in Berkeley. And as we had mentioned, Larry had done the twin roles of activism and journalism, and I guess activist journalism, in both in print and in radio. And I guess your longest commitment was at KPFA and with Pacifica. And I guess we should open up the phone lines at this point. We have only gotten into the 70s and we went to get up through the 90s and into the present, but hopefully we'll be able to do that in the next half hour as people call in. So if anybody wants to talk to Larry and ask questions about Pacifica, about his life, about whatever you want, the number is 503-231-8187. So you're at Miami, and that was the first national Pacifica broadcast. And I read that a couple dozen or something stations actually picked that up.
I think the number was 18.
And so that was like a major. There's a number of these milestones, you know, that as technology developed, and as the Pacifica network developed, and as people kind of changed with the times, as you said, a new generation came into radio through the kinds of things you and other people were doing. The scene kind of changed, and so take us from there. From, you know, then you became national correspondent, I guess, after that with Pacifica.
Actually, I became station manager. What happened was we had one of Pacifica's interminable conflicts, which dated back to the 1940s, where people couldn't get along with each other and didn't have a commonality of purpose, and were stressed by not having enough money, and were infiltrated by the cops, and all kinds of stuff went on always and forever. But in the 1973-74 period, we were being torn apart by a conflict, which is depicted in that film that I hope people will go see up there, KPFA on the air. And at the end of that, it happened we were off the air for a month, the month of August, 1974, which just happened to be the month when Nixon resigned and was impeached. So here was a denouement that we had all worked towards and hoped for, and we weren't even on the air to be able to broadcast it. Very frustrating. We were picketing outside the station, which was off the air because nobody crossed our picket lines, or very few people. But when we got back on the air, we had to figure out how we were going to structure ourselves, and one of the things that happened is the staff at the time elected me as station manager. I wasn't selected by a board of directors or something like that. There was an election. Of course, I was not elected unopposed. Nothing's ever unopposed in Pacifica, but I had a large majority of people who thought that my leadership during the strike and the lockout was sufficiently good, and my ability to do what I had to do was good enough so that they elected me station manager. And I was station manager for a little over 2 years, during which time I was almost never on the air except to ask for money. I was doing all kinds of administrative things. The station's finances were a nightmare. Its legal situation was terrible. I had my hands full. So, and I was doing a lot of personnel management, trying to, and people will again see some of this in that documentary, KPFA on the Air. I was trying to manage a very disparate staff of people who, in many cases, didn't get along with each other, and trying to keep them from killing each other so that we could at least put them on the air so that they could deal with whether they're supposed to deal with and not with each other. It was a very difficult time. It was the most difficult job I ever had, station manager, KPFA.
I can only imagine.
And when I left that, I jumped into commercial radio, back into commercial radio, because for one thing, I was broke. We weren't able to pay hardly anything in those years. And for another thing, I'd had enough of this kind of internal craziness. And I got a job as a newscaster and talk show host on, once again, KSAN, the primary rock station, underground rock in the United States in San Francisco. And I had a Sunday morning talk show called The Talkies. And that was I went from the worst job I ever had in my life at KPFA to the best job I ever had in my life, which was working at KSAN, because it's impossible to imagine now in the era of deregulation, but all music stations in those years and had news departments and talk shows and public affairs shows. They had to, because there was something called the Fairness Doctrine, and you had to have your license qualified by the FCC, and you had to prove you were serving the community interest. And playing music 24/7 and commercials wasn't in the community interest. So a lot of these stations, like ours, had a full-service news department. We had news every hour, pretty much from 6 a.m. to 8 p.m. We had a Sunday morning talk show. We had specials. And I worked with a very talented group of people, very supportive group of people. Some of it was very creative. We made tape collages. A man named Scoop Nisker worked there then. Was a good friend of mine and still is. And I did regular news, such as it was, regular, as well as the Sunday morning talk shows, which was enormously popular, until around 1979, when the station got sold and the rock and roll format changed to country and western, and we were all fired.
So, Larry, we actually do have a couple callers, and I do want to mention that that film you're talking about, KPFA on the Air, will be at the Hollywood Theater. That's at Northeast 41st and Sandy Boulevard. That's Sunday, this coming Sunday, November 3rd at 7 p.m. That's KPFA on the Air at the Hollywood Theater. And, I just wanted, before we get to our first caller, which will in 30 seconds, you know, it is impossible to imagine that, because, I mean, I listen to sometimes to KGON and KINK here, the FM rock stations. There's others, too. And I believe the only time you hear public affairs, I think, is about like 6 o'clock on Sunday morning. They must have this sort of obligatory hour of public affairs or something to meet some sort of requirement. I don't know what it is. But, yeah, I that's really...
That's exactly what it is. It's obligatory, and they say, I mean, one of the blind spots built in by industry lobbyists in Washington with the FCC has always been, well, we run public affairs. We have a great show every week called You and the World, or, you know, You're a Teenager and You, or whatever the hell it is. And we run it every week. What they don't say is they run it 4 to 5 a.m.
Right.
And the FCC blindly accepts this as, you know, serving the community when there's like five people listening. So, yeah, the whole effort of keeping radio as a medium of communication on a meaningful level, rather than just as an entertainment medium to make money. Commercial radio has been a colossal failure over the years in the United States.
Okay, well, let's go to our first caller. Jack is on the line.
Hi. I'm calling to see if you could comment on, or if you ever met, cross paths with Bonnie Faulkner, who does an interview show at KPFA.
Yeah, I know a little about her program. I maybe met her once or twice. I used to listen to it a little when I was there, up until around 7 years ago. I'm your ultimate anti-conspiracist in the world. I believe that they, who we are opposed to, get everything they need to do done without having to do it in secret. And people who would lead us through trains of free association that seem to lead to conclusions that, in my mind, aren't conclusions at all, but speculation, are a waste of time. And so that's my take on that kind of program.
Okay. Thanks for your answer on that.
Well, that could lead into a extended conversation, but since we only have 20, 25 minutes left, let's stay focused for now. Do we have another caller? No other callers, but you can call at 503-231-8187. My name is Paul Rowland. This is Talk Radio, Ordinarily Positively Revolting with Ani and Lynn. They're on vacation. I'm taking over for today, and I'm speaking with Larry Bensky, as you've been hearing, longtime media activist with in both print and radio, mostly with KPFA. He's been talking also about his experience with KSAN in San Francisco, yeah, obviously KSAN, and the way the media landscape has changed so dramatically, the way underground FM rock was so different back then, and lots more we could talk about. But then you went back to Pacifica after that, I take it.
Right, I did. What happened was I was I was brokenhearted by an experience I had in commercial radio. In 1978, we had the killings of Mayor Milk and Supervisor Moscone here and People's Temple. The sense of shock and horror and community loss when hundreds and hundreds of people were killed by this crazy man Jim Jones, and then one out of control former cop and firefighter in City Hall killed a mayor and our first openly gay supervisor. I was right on the scene for both of those. I could have been at the People's Temple killings, but for a missed phone call, I was actually enrolled to signed up to go down there with the journalists who went to Jonestown. But I missed a phone message and didn't get the information about the flight, so I could have been one of those killed down there, along with Congressman Leo Ryan. I knew Mayor Moscone and Supervisor Milk very well, and I was at City Hall minutes after they were shot, broadcasting live from there. And the whole effect of that was completely disheartening and destabilizing. And I stayed on the air for several months after that, but my heart wasn't really in it. I felt that that this had reached an all-time low. And people kept telling me, oh, we're so glad you're there, Larry, to describe all this to us. And I said, yeah, I'm glad I'm able to give that service, but I'm doing it, brokenhearted, and I want to get myself back to a better place. So I left radio for a few years. I became a manager of a record store. Sounds funny in retrospect. And I produced radio commercials for a living and did all kinds of things other than be on the air. And then I started getting job offers again from filling here, there, and the radio, and I realized I liked it. And if you fast forward to 1987, several years later, I was walking my dog one day in Berkeley, and a car pulled up, and it was the station manager at that time of KPFA. I had gone back on the air at KPFA as a volunteer programmer. I'd also been to Nicaragua, and I produced a documentary film about the Sandinistas. And he said to me, Larry, there are these hearings beginning in Washington next week. I know you've been following this whole Iran-Contra thing, and we're thinking of broadcasting it live. Would you be interested? Because you do live radio so well, and you know this type of thing. And I said, well, tell me more about it. And it turned, and he said, it'll only last a few weeks, and we'll fly you back there, and we have a producer, and blah, blah, blah. And I said, oh, yeah, okay, well, I think I can clear my life out enough. And so I flew back there. Well, it didn't last a few weeks. It lasted several months. It became a major, major national and international scene. Me and my then-producer, Bill Wax, were a team of two, whereas everybody else had hundreds of people running around Capitol Hill. And there we were all day long on the air with the Iran-Contra hearings, some or all of which, by the way, I believe was broadcast on KABU.
Mm-hmm.
KABU,
I
want to tell listeners out there, is a treasure, and I hope you continue to support it. Of all the affiliate stations, when I was doing national programming for KPFA, there were really only three that I felt had a presence in the community where we heard from listeners, that they were real. There were a lot of other stations, but they were very small. KABU in Portland was one of them, KGNU in Boulder, Colorado, and WMNF in Tampa were our lead three stations. And I could always count on hearing from people from KABU. They were intelligent, they were sensitive, they were thoughtful. And I know you guys have gone through a whole bunch of struggles up there similar to the other Pacifica struggles. But above and beyond that, it's a precious, precious community resource. Anyway, there we were. There I was in Washington broadcasting this. And we were the only place broadcasting this nationwide. I think NPR picked up a little of it after a while. But here was Pacifica, you know. And in Washington, D.C., we'd be the only place that had it on live. So if Nancy Reagan was in a taxi or a limousine or Oliver North was on his way to Capitol Hill, he had to listen to the Pacifica station. He had to listen to me. And I was very conscious of that power because there was an enormous amount of feedback. I mean, we were getting dozens of letters and phone calls every single day. This was pre-email and pre-internet. And we were doing the best damn job we knew how and won all kinds of awards for it. And afterward, that kind of established me as a national programmer outside of Pacifica and inside a little bit. But inside, Pacifica was always described to me by one of our former national program directors back in the day. We had national programs. She said, you know, Larry, Pacifica is like a crab pot. Have you ever seen people catch crabs and put them in a pail? And one crab tries to climb out and save its life, and the other crabs will grab onto it and drag it back in. Well, you're the crab that's trying to crawl up, and all the rest of them are always going to drag you down.
Well, we can go. Boy, let's go back to that after we take another caller or two. Jim, you're on the line.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Bansky, I call to tell you how great I thought your coverage of the Iran-Contra hearings were. I listened on WBAI, and for 3 days it was stunning coverage. And naturally, I imagined that the national media, the New York Times and networks, they'd be awash with reportage of the details. And there wasn't a peep.
That's true. That's why we were alternative media.
Well, good luck. And very nice to hear from you. And I'm happy to be supporting this station. Have a good day.
Thank you very much. Keep supporting it.
Do we have another caller? Eric, you're on the line.
Yeah, hi.
Hey.
It's good to hear Vlash from the past, K-San.
Yo, you listen.
All right, a K-San listener.
Great. Where are you calling from?
I'm calling from Wilsonville right now. I'm a little concerned about the darkness that's been pulled down in our shades. I'm a producer at Metro East Community Television. And when I was up in Tacoma, you could not get near a studio to produce anything.
Well, you know, it's really interesting. I'm glad you brought that up, because one of the reasons why we were able to succeed in so far as we did for years at Pacifica is we had a much less diffuse media platform than people have right now. I said I'm a college teacher. I've been a college teacher since 1987 for 21 years in state college here. And none of my students now ever listens to the radio at all. I mean, not at all. They pick up music on the internet. They pick up information from various websites and Twitters and things like that. If you ask them what stations they listen to, maybe they'll tune in occasionally to get a traffic report or something like that. But the radio is kind of like gone by as a medium, and one of the reasons Pacifica has fallen apart is it failed to understand the change in delivery platforms. When I retired 7 years ago, we were just beginning to get into podcasting, and we had an international presence on the web. And people were listening, there's several hundred listeners all over the world. We could chart them. But as an institution, Pacifica completely missed the boat because they were too busy fighting with each other inside about whatever they fight with each other inside about. And so the expansion of people's range of possibilities for information from the time Pacifica was founded, actually as an AM station back in the 40s, and then it went to FM in the late 40s when FM was first coming into being, and then the explosion of television and cable television and community television and then the internet. Now there's so much fragmentation that you have to be able to be smart and hip enough to ride that wave, as, by the way, Amy Goodman has with Democracy Now! And all of Pacifica should have followed her lead, but didn't. Instead, they tried to get rid of her.
Well, speaking of which...
unfortunately, they failed in doing so, but all of the expansion and delivery platforms means that, you know, when these cable stations first came in, they had to promise the community that gave them the franchise that they would have community production studios with resources. And here in San Francisco and in Berkeley, they did. So you would have one channel that was actually dedicated to putting out a professional-looking picture and sound where people could come in and have talk shows or play music or do whatever they wanted. As the industry continued to lobby and get these things written out of contracts, cable television deteriorated to the point where it's now at. If you do see a community station that has very poor visual and audio values, people are not brought up to watch that kind of thing. They're brought up on very slick production values in the national entertainment state. And if you can't provide that to them, they're not going to stop and look at you. Same thing on radio. If you don't know how to talk, or your microphones are off when you start to talk, or your radio or your music is too loud one minute, too soft the next, people are just going to say bye-bye. And same with writing. You know, when I started out, we were talking before, Paul, about being a writer and an editor. It didn't matter that what I was doing was, you know, alternative or political journalism or progressive journalism or whatever. If people couldn't write and their articles were full of misspellings and they couldn't put together sequential reasoning paragraphs, so what that they were on the right side with you? They couldn't communicate. So you have to have a respect for the craft before you can legitimately think of yourself as somebody who is able to reach out and do whatever it is you want to do.
So, Eric, are you still on the line? Okay, so we do have another caller. Mitch, yes. Go ahead.
Well, I want to take the opportunity to apologize to Larry Bensky, because the last time we'd seen each other was at a scuffling match at the great journalist Gary Webb's talk before Gary Webb committed suicide at the UC Berkeley Journalism School. And what led to that pushing match between Mr. Bensky and I think, speaking from my end, was a disease that now, having left the Bay Area and left the Pacifica orb, and a little bit of reflection, I think comes from a more radical-than-thou mindset that sets in among activists. Whether they're activists slash journalists, I don't want to speak for Larry. I'm only speaking for myself, and I never got to the point of being a journalist except for alternative weeklies in the Bay Area, where I used to source Larry, especially on Iran-Contra. And I just wanted to apologize to him for that shoving match that we had at the J School, and lament the fact that there isn't a place where a person of Larry's skills could actually earn a living in mass media, because Lord knows mass media needs it.
And this answers the question, whatever became of Mitch Ritter?
Yes, Mitch Ritter is now working in a parking garage in downtown Portland, where I'm speaking to you from. So,
oh, Mitch, you should be doing better than that. First of all, you have a lot of background in retail and books and music and stuff like that. What happened to all that?
Yeah, well, records, no one listens to them or goes out, and like you said, it's the kind of thing where the Neil Postman book kind of said it all. Media has become entertainment, and any part of it that used to belong to education is history.
Well, good luck to you, Mitch, and thanks. It's good to hear from you again.
Good luck to you, Larry.
Hey, thanks for calling. So so you obviously remember the context for that. Maybe we can use that as a springboard to talk about whatever that issue was that was going on between you and Mitch at the time.
I was trying to put Gary Webb, who did a lot of valuable reporting for the San Jose Mercury News about the CIA and drug conspiracies to smuggle drugs in the United States. I was trying to put that into some context where we could find out if it was true or not, not just worship at his throne, which is what I always do with people from the left, right, or center. I want to know what the strong points are and what they're talking about, and I want to know what the weak points are. And to me, although Gary Webb had done a lot of valuable reporting and actually was persecuted for it, he left a lot of questions unanswered, and I wanted to get at what some of those questions were. There were, on the other hand, a bunch of true believers who wanted to put him on a throne, much as they did the Christic Institute during Iran-Contra, and much as they did the Weathermen and the Weather Underground during the Vietnam War era. And I wanted to talk about what those people and places were beyond what they were saying. I don't believe in echo chambers. You know, that was never my idea. I've seen echo chambers in history turn out horrible results. And if we are going to have a more just world, a more peaceful world, an environmentally more sane world, we have to ask ourselves the same question that outsiders are asking us, without at the same time becoming complete skeptics and cynics about what we think is true. And it's a very fine line. And I believe in the Gary Webb and the CIA Contra era and the drug smuggling and all of that, a lot of people had gone over it. And so that's what that evening at the J School at UC Berkeley was about. It was the true believers against those who either were skeptical about it or didn't know very much about it and wanted to find out more. And one of the contributions that stations like KPFA and Pacifica and KBOO can give is to have a place open where people can ask questions and make statements and try to figure out what's what and what is true and what isn't. You know, my whole impetus for getting into the lifetime, a lot of what I've done in my lifetime, was growing up as I did, as a child of immigrant parents in New York City in the early 1940s, during the Second World War, when there was an exterminationist campaign going on against Jewish people in Europe. And I grew up with this knowledge and with watching in childhood horror at the enveloping and trying to figure out afterward how the hell this had started and begun and how, what we could do in the future to prevent it. So I was, you know, very early on as a young child against injustice, against persecution, and against categorical people who felt that they knew the truth, like Hitler or Stalin or anybody like that, and it was okay to kill as many people as you needed to in order to get that truth implemented. That has always seemed to me the ultimate thing to stay away from and to fight against. And so in my life and career as a broadcaster, as a teacher, as a journalist, I'm always trying to get people to back off and say, wait a minute, you know, what are these drone killings all about these days? Who the hell said it was okay to push a button in Tampa, Florida, and wipe out a village in Waziristan or Yemen? What is the chain of command and responsibility here? What is the democratic, small d, administration of this? I'm teaching a course in American presidency right now in State College, and I'm, you know, the right wing's worst nightmare. I'm getting my students to question authority and to question actions that I believe lead to horrible results, criminal results. I'm teaching another class in Richard Nixon now, of all people, at the Lifetime Learning Institute at Cal. And trying to get people to look into and understand, how did Nixon become such a monster that he was able to have a monster like Henry Kissinger committing war crimes all over the planet? And these kinds of questions we need to be asking ourselves. So, community radio, when I was a part of it, asked those questions. But as I've said several times during this hour, creating an echo chamber where all you hear is yourselves drawing conclusions from whatever material, talking to each other, seems to me to be a waste of time after a while. There's a bigger world than that, and we've got to engage with it.
Well, Larry, I am speaking with Larry Bensky, longtime Pacific Radio and many other things. And the hour is rapidly drawing to a close, as you well know from having done talk radio yourself. And there's so many directions. Not all that much control can be had since you obviously want to get a lot of callers. And we've really only got... We haven't even got into the 1990s Pacifica controversy, but Per Fagering did have Mariah Gallard, Gallardin on yesterday, and they talked extensively about that. And there's also a discussion in the film, which is this Sunday, KPFA on the air at the Hollywood Theater, Northeast 41st and Sandy. So come check that out. And I'm sure I can provide some links to various things about this. It can be there on my blog, or I'll post it up to the Positively Revolting. If you go on to kboo.fm and go to the schedule and click on this date and Positively Revolting, and there'll be some links there. And
Ron, would you please put up a link to a site called Radio Survivor?
Okay.
Which is maintained by a UC Santa Cruz professor, Matthew Lazar. Radiosurvivor.org, I think it is. You'll find the whole depressing saga of what's happened to Pacifica on there.
And obviously there are different sides to that, and the sides have shifted at that time, and hopefully will also shift again. I know there's still some rancor amongst various people who were involved in the Pacifica controversy in the 1990s. I don't know if it's possible to come to reconciliations over that, or maybe they don't even need to. In any case, I do want to, since this is talk radio, we do have one more call. Eric, I guess, has one more question.
Yeah, I'm currently homeless because I was locked out of my dorm at Portland State University. Universities apparently are exempt from landlord-tenant law. They can drop a hat, give you an email, be out in 24 hours, and lock you out.
Eric, I'm sorry. It sounds like you've got a difficult situation, and ordinarily we would be able to talk about that, but we only have 4 minutes left, and I'm talking with Larry Benske, and I want to give him a chance to sort of say his last words about, you know, what we've been talking about here. But maybe if you could call back at another time, and we could talk about that. I'm sorry to cut you off like that, Eric, but we're coming up on the 9 o'clock hour, and thanks for calling, though. Larry, I'd like to give you the last few minutes here to sort of put you in a difficult spot and try to like sum up somehow, or just say whatever's on your mind right now, basically, I guess.
Well, whatever's on my mind is I wished I was able, you invited me to come up there, and I really wanted to come this weekend to be present at the screening of that film, but I can't because I'm heavily involved in being producer, director, and artistic designer of a November 14th evening we're putting on here in the Bay Area. It's the 100th anniversary of the publication of In Search of Lost Time by Marcel Proust. Those who were listening earlier know that I've spent the last 7 years of my life doing something completely different pretty much from what I did before, wanting to spend more time listening to music and knowing about music and art and culture, wanting to spend more time in France where I once lived, and I'm bilingual in French. And so I have this website called radioproust.org, which I invite your listeners to take a look at. And through that, they were able to write to me. There's a email on there, proust@bard.edu. On the radio scene, you know, I'm really proud of what I and so many other people were able to accomplish at KPFA and Pacifica over the years. I deeply regret that things have reached the stage that they did, where we had to have that terrible, terrible conflict when that film was made in the early 2000s. I'm glad I was able to come back and do 7 more years of radio after that.
You were actually fired in, 1999, right?
Right, I was fired for speaking out on the air against what management was doing. I lost my job, I lost my radio program. But I didn't lose the support of the listeners, and I didn't lose the support of my fellow workers who hired me back as soon as they could. And I just want to say that good-hearted people will, and people who are trying to do the right thing, are always going to find the way to speak out. And we need to be telling each other stories. We need to be doing research. We need to be holding each other's hands, which is why Occupy was such a great phenomenon a couple of years ago. It'll come again, folks. Don't doubt it. Look at history. It always does. And when it does, we've got to figure out a way to make it last better and longer than we have in the past. I consider that there were a lot of successes in my life in what I did. I certainly concede that there are a lot of failures in what I was trying to do. But that doesn't mean it wasn't worth trying, and it doesn't mean I won't still try as long and as hard as I can. So thank you very much for the opportunity, Paul, and I hope as many people will, as possible, will go see that film. had I come up there, I was looking forward to going to some great brew pub afterward and getting down with a bunch of dozens of people, and maybe that'll happen sometime in the future.
I certainly hope so. I certainly hope so. And now that we've sort of established this connection, I'd like to have the chance possibly of talking in the future. And I think this has been a really interesting dialogue. I've talked to other people in community radio land, and I think that's one thing we really need to do, establish these. And of course, it's been established for a long time. There's a whole community radio network. I've just recently come back to KBOO after many years away myself, but I can't go into all that right now, and we're about out of time, and so I would like to thank you once again, Larry Bensky, for being with us on Talk Radio here on KBOO Community Radio.
It's been a great honor and a pleasure.
Okay, and that was Larry Bensky, and stay tuned for more great programming here on your community radio, KBOO 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon. Thanks for listening.
Truth is, I thought it mattered. I thought that music mattered. But does it bollocks?
The listening public.
Not compared.
The other point of view.
There was a strong sense that this was the beginning of something that would spread across the country.
On Sunday, November 3rd, at the historic Hollywood Theater, KBOO presents an exclusive benefit screening of the film KPFA On the Air.
This documentary tells the powerful story of the beginnings of listener-sponsored radio in the United States with the birth of Pacifica in Berkeley in 1949.
KPFA On the Air chronicles the origins of the free speech movement, the first stirrings of the student movements at Berkeley, and opposition to the Vietnam War in the early 1960s.
Eventually spawning a network of free-form, independent radio stations across the country, including KBOO, which came on the air in 1968. So come join us at the Hollywood Theater, Northeast 41st and Sandy Boulevard, Sunday, November 3rd, at 7 in the evening.
Help keep community radio strong and thriving into the future.
Muertos Northwest invites you to the 5th annual Dia de los Muertos celebration, Saturday, November 2nd, at the Audio Cinema, 226 Southeast Madison Street, Portland, under the Hawthorne Bridge. Celebration of life and death. Come help the spirits of your loved ones return with their favorite food, drinks, and plenty of dancing. Bring an item to add to the community altar. Muertos face painting for the young and old, sugar skull decorating, hot chocolate and pan dulce will be served. Come check out Mariachi Portland, Conjunto Alegre, and Rafa and the Deadliest Catch Band. Come for the Muertos, stay for the food, drinks, and dancing. Sponsored in part by KBOO, Tequila Cuervo, and Cover Oregon. Visit Facebook Muertos Northwest.